From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a crime writer who was once on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Edward Bunker started writing when he was behind bars. His 1973 novel, No Beast So Fierce, written in San Quentin, is about an ex-con trying to go straight. It was adapted into the film Straight Time, which starred Dustin Hoffman. No Beast So Fierce has just been republished. Bunker spent over three decades of his life in and out of reform schools and prisons. Also today, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews reissues of the three albums Don Cherry made for the Blue Note label in the 60s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At least two foreign journalists were killed today by an angry mob in Mogadishu. The killings were apparently in retaliation for the latest United Nations attack on targets linked to fugitive clan leader Mohamed Farah Aidid. NPR's Daniels Werdling reports.
When journalists heard the UN assault, in which Cobra helicopter gunships bombed the house of one of Aidid's top aides, they rushed out of their hotel and drove to see the damage, as journalists there usually do. In fact, an Aidid spokesman apparently encouraged the journalists to see the site. But when the reporters and camera crews arrived at the scene, a mob confronted them. Two photographers with Reuters and the Associated Press were killed. A Reuters cameraman was shot and badly beaten. Two other journalists are reported missing and feared dead. A few weeks ago, a French journalist was shot and killed near the city. Since U.S. helicopters and planes began bombing Aidid's compounds last month, some of his supporters have vowed to kill any Westerners, including journalists, to retaliate. One of Aidid's spokesmen said today's U.N. attacks killed more than 70 Somalis. That report has not been confirmed. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Nairobi.
Vice President Al Gore flew over the flooded farmland around Grafton, Illinois today. He described floodwaters so extensive that it wouldn't be recognizable as farmland until the top of a barn could be seen above water. He later took a boat tour of Grafton itself, and at one point he had to duck as the boat floated under power lines. The vice president talked with President Clinton by telephone and then promised flood victims that there would be a forceful, coordinated response to the disaster. Prior to his tour of flood damage in the Midwest, Vice President Gore delivered a speech to the annual convention of the NAACP in Indianapolis. Don Gagne reports.
The Clinton administration is attempting to mend fences with black leaders who were outraged when the president withdrew the nomination of Lonnie Guinier to be the nation's top civil rights lawyer. Today, Vice President Gore stressed to NAACP delegates that they do have a friend in the White House after 12 years of the policies of Ronald Reagan and George Bush.
Ladies and gentlemen, that time is over. I come to you today to affirm to you that our administration understands, to pledge to you our unshakable commitment to your cause. We will fight with you.
The vice president also promised that the person ultimately chosen by the Clinton administration to take the post Lonnie Guinier had been nominated for will be someone the Civil Rights Organization will be proud of. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Indianapolis.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points to close at 3,524. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up almost 2 points at 707.7. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The head of the UN Commission on Iraqi Weapons is reportedly preparing to go to Baghdad in an effort to resolve a dispute over monitoring of Iraq's missile test sites. UN diplomats say Rolf Acaeus wants to leave for Baghdad tomorrow after briefing the UN Security Council on Iraq's refusal to allow the test sites to be sealed. A UN team left Iraq abruptly yesterday after the Iraqis refused to let them put seals on test equipment at the sites to make sure they weren't used to test long-range missiles. A strong earthquake in the Sea of Japan has sent tidal waves crashing onto the northernmost island, Hokkaido, as well as a small island nearby. As many as 9 people are reported dead and dozens are missing. Experts say it was one of the biggest undersea earthquakes ever recorded in the region. Philip Short reports for the BBC.
The earthquake, measuring 7.8 on the Richter scale, had its epicenter under the sea in an area southwest of Hokkaido. The worst damage was on the small island of Akushiri, where a hotel collapsed. Local police say people are buried under the rubble. Electricity on the island was cut, and the government declared a state of emergency and announced it was sending in troops for rescue operations. Japanese television said houses on the island were damaged by the earthquake and by 10-foot-high waves that pounded the coast afterwards. Aftershocks are continuing. In the last major earthquake in the area 10 years ago, more than 100 people died and 160 were injured.
Tokyo. Philip Short in Tokyo. Nigeria's military rulers decided today to hold new presidential elections before they give up power to a civilian government. Military dictator Ibrahim Babangida claimed vote fraud in last month's election and declared it void before the final results could be announced. Opponents say the claims of vote fraud were just an excuse for the military to remain in power. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Edward Bunker is a crime writer who has never made it to the bestseller list, but was briefly on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. Bunker spent much of his life in prison, doing time for robbery, burglary, and selling drugs. He wrote his first novel, No Beast So Fierce, in San Quentin. The novel, about an ex-con who can't get legit work and turns again to crime, was made into the film Straight Time, which starred Dustin Hoffman. A new edition of No Beast So Fierce has just been published by Vintage. In the introduction, William Styron writes, Edward Bunker is one of a small handful of American writers who have created authentic literature out of their experiences as criminals and prisoners. Bunker, who is now 59, has been out of prison since 1975, but before that time, he spent nearly all of his years behind bars except those of his earliest childhood. Bunker's writing credits include the screenplay for Runaway Train. While he was in prison, he wrote an occasional column for The Nation. Here's a reading from the opening of No Beast So Fierce.
I sat on the lidless toilet at the rear of the cell, shining the hideous bulb-toe shoes that were issued to those being released. Through my mind ran an exultant chant, I'll be a free man in the morning. But for all the exultation, the joy of leaving after 8 calendars in prison was not unalloyed. My goal in buffing the ugly shoes was not so much to improve their appearance as to relieve tension. I was more nervous in facing release on parole than I had been on entering so long ago. It helped slightly to know that such apprehensiveness was common, though often denied, by men to whom the world outside was increasingly vague as the years passed away. Enough years in prison, and a man would be as ill-equipped to handle the demands of freedom as a Trappist monk thrown into the maelstrom of New York City. At least the monk would have his faith to sustain him, while a former prisoner would possess memory of previous failure, of prison, and the incandescent awareness of being an ex-convict, a social outcast. I finished with the shoes, set them beneath the bunk, and stood up. The cell was small, less than 5 feet wide. The bunk occupied so much space that my shoulder brushed against the wall as I passed by the bunk toward the front. How many hours had I spent in this cell, from 4 in the afternoon until 7 in the morning, for 8 long years? It was beyond computing in my mind. Now the cell was especially barren. I'd given away my small collection of books, the braided throw rug, the soap, shaving cream and toothpaste, everything. Ah, screw it, I muttered, meaninglessly, without object in mind. I looked out through the bars, 13 of them, set so close together that only a hand and wrist could pass through. Around this cell were 500 others, most of them containing 2 prisoners. I'd angled a single cell after 5 years. We were all locked down for the night. A typewriter clattered nearby, a letter home or a petition for habeas corpus. Live steam in a pipe thunked and clanked. The loudest sound was several convicts entertaining themselves with a game of the dozens. It had been going on for 30 minutes, but only now caught my attention.
Thank you for reading that. Edward Bunker, do you know that on the author bio, on the press release that accompanies the republication of No Beast So Fierce, it says, Edward Bunker has not been arrested in over 20 years. It's an unusual thing to find on an author bio. Did you want that mentioned on there?
Yeah, sure I want that mentioned. Yeah, because, people have the image of the convict writer Jack Abbott kind of ruined things. And Smith and other people who, have written and have, people who Buckley went to bat for Smith and Mailer for Abbott and, and they... got in trouble quick, you know, committed rapes, murders, robberies. You know, I'm somebody that's really been rehabilitated. So, I like the idea that I haven't been arrested for 20 years. You know, that's kind of changes things, you know. I mean, don't you think it's salient?
Absolutely. How many times did you get out of prison and end up going back in?
Three times. I was a three-time, well, you know, yeah, three times. I was a three-time loser.
Why is it so hard to live a straight life after prison?
The term habitual criminal is really an appropriate term. But there's a whole lot of things. One's life, you're locked. When you're in prison, your dreams have no limit. You can dream about anything, and the reality of the world is that when you get out, you're locked out of society. I mean, there's really, the idea of the prodigal is really not accepted too much in Puritan America. I mean, I've had people tell me that they shouldn't allow me to write, and, you know, just, you're locked out of society. That's an essential fact once you've been in. And you're accepted, and you have a group that you're accepted by.
In prison.
In prison, amongst thieves and criminals.
Now, your novel, No Beast So Fierce, has just been republished. What's the story behind the new edition?
How did it get republished?
Yeah.
Essentially, my friend James Ellroy introduced me to his French publisher, who liked my books, who took all my books, and they published them in France, this one first, and they were very successful. And with the my friend Bill Styron wrote an introduction for me. So with that working for me, with an introduction by Styron, and it's a pretty good book, they decided to republish it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think without the introduction it would have been republished.
You wrote this book while you were in prison?
Yeah.
Were you encouraged to write while you were in prison?
When I was real young, I was encouraged to write. There was an old silent film star that used to write me correspond with me and sent me magazines and subscriptions to the New York Times, and she encouraged me to write, and I'd read I read a lot, and I'd read that, I know that Cervantes wrote part of Don Quixote in prison, and that Voltaire was in prison, and actually if you go all the way back to Socrates, you know, that was the first prison writer is, and there's been Genet, and so, you know, there's a lot of examples of people who have used time in prison to write books.
You were aware of that while you were writing in prison?
I wasn't aware of that when I first started. I don't all of that much. The first thing that I had was Chessman. I was up in the hole, which was right behind death row when Carol Chessman was up there, and I used to talk to him through the ventilators. And early in 19, I was 18 or 19, and a sergeant brought an Argosy magazine around from death row, and they had excerpted the first chapter of Chessman's book, Cell 2455, Death Row. It was a chapter about an execution. And it was unbelievable to me that a convict in prison, on death row, or just in prison, could get published in Argosy magazine, could accomplish that, and it mentioned that the book was going to be published. And when it was published, it was a smash bestseller internationally. So that's really what started me, you know, writing.
But what made you realize you had it in you to write? What made you realize you wanted to and that you could do it?
Well, I'd already from when I was very young, I've always been a voracious reader. It was kind of an escape from the ugliness of my life, that I would always, even when I was 7, 8, 10, 12, I was a voracious reader. I didn't have any discrimination, but I'd read whatever came to my hand when I was in juvenile hall and reform school, or as long as they give me a book, whatever they did with me, or anything to read, I could pass the time. I could occupy myself. So when I finally got to prison, I started to read with a little more discretion. And, I mean, to be a writer was to be the greatest. That was to be the magic man. I mean, at that time, more so then than today. And I don't think that I had any talent. If you read the first things that I wrote, they were pretty bad. I wrote 6 novels and hundreds of stories before I got published. I really think that more than talent, it was perseverance.
How did you get an agent when you were in prison?
I wrote this agent and told him that I was here in prison and I aspired to write, and they had done a an issue in Esquire magazine about Ryder, the New York literary world, and they had a chart of, you know, how they do in magazines and these agents and that agent. And this was Ayn Rand's agent, originally had been Ayn Rand's agent, and was the real old agency in New York, one of the first ones. So I wrote them and explained my situation and if they'd be interested in reading my stuff. And so I sent it to them, and they said, we can't sell this. We do anything else, send it to us. So every time I'd write one of those novels, every two or three years, I'd send them when they'd say no. And finally, on the sixth one, he said, I think I can sell this, you know.
You wrote six novels before the one was published.
Right. I wrote for 17 years before I got published.
Did you show it to any of your fellow prisoners?
Oh, yeah. I used to write dirty stories that I'd rent for cigarettes on the joint, too, you know. That's how I made my cigarettes, you know, and coffee. And I'd write reports. After a couple of years, I had very, you know, powerful clerical positions in the state prison. I was like, you know, associate warden's clerk, and because I could write so well. And, you know, those reports that go to Sacramento and the district attorney's office and things like that, so I did a lot of that writing, you know, report writing and stuff. And I would write letters for guys, and I got into law. I studied law. I worked as a law librarian for 3 or 4 years.
Well, your novel is about an unrepentant criminal. I imagine that didn't really help your reputation among prison authorities.
No. In fact, I once wrote an essay on how to commit an armed robbery, a primer on planning and commission of successful armed robberies. They found it in my cell. They really didn't like that. But I don't think they paid any attention to this book. I don't think they read very much, the prison authorities. And I wanted to write about an unrepentant criminal because there's a question always between how much is choice and how much is determined by life. I mean, I think my observation in life is that people who succeed always attribute their success to their own virtues, and people that fail always blame their failure on bad luck. And I don't know which is luck and which is virtue. And I wanted to be somebody that chose to be a criminal. I mean, I made my, whatever his predisposition by circumstances, I believe in free choice. He chose to be a criminal. I chose to be a criminal, you know, because I wouldn't be what society would let me be.
Well, actually, let me quote your character here. Your character says that he went to war with society and decided to be what he was with a vengeance, a criminal. Crime was where I belonged, where I was comfortable. Society had made me what I was, and I glorified in what I was. Did you feel that way?
Yeah, I'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. I mean, you know, I wrote 200 letters once for a job, and I had a good education. You know, I score very high on any kind of academic tests, and I type 100 words a minute. I can do a lot of things. And I wrote 200 letters. I didn't get one reply. They wanted to relegate me to a car wash. Once you're locked out of society, once you're an ex-convict and you're locked out of society, they're not going to let you in. You're not going to get to play the game. And so why not be a criminal?
Don't take this the wrong way, but I'm wondering, say, one of those times when you got out of prison, you ended up going back in. Say I owned some kind of business and I'd given you a managerial job there. Do you think you would have stolen from me?
Oh, no. No, no. I'm an honorable man. I'm very honorable. I'm more honorable than most of the people I deal with in Hollywood, you know. I'm certainly more honorable than an agent.
But you've stolen plenty of things. You've even done bank heist.
Right. I just take a gun and that's, you know, I put it in your face and take your money.
And then that's honorable?
Well, it's not dishonorable. You know, what's the difference of taking, morally, what's the difference of taking California from Mexico or taking money from a bank? Answer me. What's the moral difference?
Well, I mean, one's in your control and one isn't. You can't just kind of excuse your own personal acts
I don't
by
excuse
saying other
it.
People did it.
My character doesn't excuse it. I just put the realities of the world. I said my character chose to be a criminal. If
right.
you don't like it, then punish me, you know, or do what you
right.
can.
Right.
But I'm not going to, you know, cry and say, poor me, you know.
Right. No,
I didn't want to create that kind of character that said, you know, poor me, society, you know, I'm black, I'm this, I'm that, you know, and this is my justification. I said, I don't need any justification.
My guest is Edward Bunker. His novel, No Beast So Fierce, has just been republished. Back after a break, this is Fresh Air. The novel is No Beast So Fierce, written by my guest, Edward Bunker. It's just been published in a new edition by the Vintage Crime series. Your character commits crimes at the end and gets away with it, much to his surprise.
Yeah.
Was that a fantasy of yours, to be able to do it and not be caught?
Well, if you, you know, actually, statistically, few crimes are solved. I mean, you know, you get most criminals, but you get them by repetition. You know, they only have to fail once, but any particular crime is, you know, there's a, you know, a lot of crimes are committed and people get away with them all the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, the novel No Beast So Fierce was first published in 1973. I believe you were paroled that year also?
Yeah.
Was that before or after the publication?
No, I was in when it was published.
And when were you paroled?
I was paroled later on, about a year and a half later.
Uh-huh. What was it like for you that time when you got out of prison? You know, you had a novel. You could have gone to a bookstore and bought looked at your book there.
Well, it was very different. I left in a limousine. They sent a limousine for me. We were going to make a movie. I was in pre-production of making Straight Time. And so they sent a limousine for me. That was a far different situation. Of course, they could have taken me around the block and dumped me out. I didn't care after they got away, you know, my relationship with the world changed.
Was that the last time you were in prison?
Yep. And the last time I was arrested.
In the introduction to your book, you thank Dustin Hoffman for carrying you for 6 months. You're referring to the time you worked with
another
him.
Book. That's in, you mean in the...
I'm sorry, that's in your other
the
book.
The dedication
yeah.
of
that's
Little
right.
Boy Blue. Yeah, he did. I mean, they hired me when I got out. They hired me as a technical consultant and paid me all the way through pre-production and production. I did an acting job. I played a role in the movie. Got
you
a
did,
SAG
yeah.
card. And so it changed my life. I mean, it didn't change me, but it changed my relationship with the world. You know, I think I've changed kind of over time by virtue of the family. I've been with the same woman for 15 years. So I changed slowly, but when I got out, I didn't have any different attitude than I'd always had. But my relationship with society changed. I'd been on the cover of Harper's Magazine. I had a book published. I had another one in production. I had a movie being made. That's a whole lot of different situation than getting out, you know, with $40 in your pocket.
Tell me about one of the days when you got out with $40 in your pocket.
Oh, well, I got out one time with 40. I had, and they'd given me the dress-out shoes. I was trying to get a job, and I remember this very clearly in Los Angeles. It was one of those hot L.A. days, you know, that really gets smoking 100 degrees, and I was... walking around, and I had blisters from these shoes, these new cheap shoes that they'd given me, these dress-out shoes. And I'm walking from job application to job application trying to get a job. And it was so bad that I had blisters on my blisters. Yeah. And no money, you know, in a little furnished room, and the rent's running out, and the parole officer's on my case. And, yeah, it was, yeah.
How long were you out?
That time?
Mm-hmm.
About 7 months, 8 months.
What landed you back in?
That time, I think I got caught with a safe in my car, a small safe in the back of my car after a long chase and some checks from another safe burglary.
You pulled a bank heist once, right?
Yeah, I pulled several.
Uh-huh.
But the one that's really funny is the one I got. I had in '72. I had been busted over the drugs, and I got out on bail, and they were following me, expecting me to pick up another load of drugs, and I was going to rob a bank in Beverly Hills and go to flee to Mexico, and I didn't know it. And they had a beeper on my car, a helicopter, and 5 carloads of narcs, and they followed me to a bank right on Wilshire Boulevard, right in the middle of Beverly Hills. And as I was robbing the bank, I looked up through the window, and there was some guy had his both hands, and he was pressed up to the glass, looking in the bank from the street. And I recognized his face. I didn't know his name, but I recognized his face, and I knew it was a cop. So I ran out the other door, and the chase was on. You know, and I wondered why I couldn't get away, but you know, the beeper and the helicopter, and they caught me over by Farmer's Market, and that was the worst. I thought I was going to get 20 years, 30 years. I thought it was all over. I was a two-time loser with a, you know, ex-convict with a bank. That's as hot as it can get, you know? And while I was in the jail, they accepted my novel. And after over a few months, then people came to my assistant. I had a lot of letters, and I tried to kill myself that night. That's the bleakest point in my life. Yeah, because I thought it was all over. I tried to hang myself, and I used a piece of pajama top, and it broke. I went out. I went unconscious, you know, and I was hanging, and it broke. When I woke up, I was on the floor.
What were your first thoughts when you woke up?
I don't remember, you know. But, you know, I was dizzy, I guess, you know. Well, that didn't work.
Were you changed afterwards? Did you know?
No, was that a great metamorphosis that happened?
Yeah,
all of us?
No, I don't think such luck, huh?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that change happens like that.
Yeah.
I don't believe in flashes of, you know, like lightning.
So you came to and you were still really depressed. You came to and you were still really depressed.
I was still really depressed, but things, you know, the world started slowly changing because I had accomplished something. Although I do know other people who have had, you know, that kind of lightning. I had a guy I know that was doing time in California, and they took him to Nevada. When he finished his sentence, he had charges pending in Nevada, and he was facing a lot of time, and he said, "Oh, he made one of those prayers, one of those deals with God. Oh, if I could get out of this, and I don't." It was an old crime, like he'd already served a sentence in California, and they were taking him there anyway. They dismissed the charges the next week, and he changed. He became a Christian minister, and he runs a home for abused children, and you know, and that was kind of like lightning. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's the only one I know of.
Do you ever go back to prison to teach now?
Yeah, I went to Terminal Island a few times. Used to have a writing class in there. And I help people as much as I can help them. Guys write me, and I read their stuff, you know.
What's it like for you now when you go in? You know, when you go into teach or whatever?
Well, it's all right. I mean, I'm a legend in my own time, you know. Or as some guy said, I'm a legend in my own slime, you know.
Edward Bunker's novel, No Beast So Fierce, has been republished by Vintage Crime. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More with Bunker in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our interview with writer Edward Bunker. He wrote the screenplay for the 1978 movie Straight Time, starring Dustin Hoffman as an ex-con trying to go straight who falls back into crime. It was based on Bunker's novel, No Beast So Fierce, which he wrote while he was in prison. It's just been republished. Bunker spent over 30 years in prison for robbery, burglary, and selling drugs. He's been living and writing on the outside since 1975. Also, Don Cherry was one of the great exponents of free jazz in the 60s. Kevin Whitehead has a review of his work from that period, the complete Blue Note recordings of Don Cherry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Somalia, U.S. gunships hit a command center of fugitive factional leader General Adid, in turn setting off mob violence, in which at least two journalists were killed. A military spokeswoman says the aim of the U.S.-led attack was to drive Adid's supporters from their base of operation, and inside the house were found computers, radios, documents, and small arms. U.N. officials say 13 Somalis were killed in the attack, and a dozen others were wounded. Adid's backers say more than 70 people were killed. Italy's defense minister has called for a suspension of combat operations in Somalia and a review of the UN mission. As Francis Kennedy reports, his comments reflect a growing rift between Rome and Washington on how the peacekeeping operation should be handled.
Defense Minister Fabio Fabri has proposed a cooling-off period to reduce tensions in Somalia, saying there was the risk of a long period of military conflict. He called for a reassessment of the relationship between the aims of the mission, reconciliation and humanitarian aid, and the means used to achieve them. After the killing of three Italian soldiers in Mogadishu, Rome has demanded a greater say in the UN command structure, because of its large troop presence and its colonial links with Somalia. Italy is concerned that U.S. air raids undo all its good work in winning the confidence of the Somali people and bringing the warring sides together. It's this emphasis on dialogue as a basis for settlement that's put Rome on a collision course with Washington and its other UNOSOM partners, who accuse it of negotiating with murderers. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
In a bid to defuse the confrontation with Iraq, the UN Security Council has decided to send its top arms official to Baghdad tomorrow. This move comes after Iraq refused to cooperate with UN weapons inspectors this weekend. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The standoff with Iraq began earlier this month when Baghdad refused to allow UN arms inspectors to install camera monitors at two missile test sites. The UN then proposed that, as an interim measure, equipment at the sites be sealed. But over the weekend, Iraq rejected this approach as well. Despite warnings that Iraq faced serious consequences if it failed to cooperate, the Security Council has decided to hold off on any aggressive action for the time being. Britain and France are said to be reluctant to confront Baghdad, and U.S. officials say that if their goals can be achieved without a military confrontation, so much the better. Instead, the Council has ordered Rolf Ikeas, the top UN arms official, to fly to Baghdad Tuesday in an effort to persuade Iraq to be more cooperative. Ikeas is scheduled to arrive in Baghdad Thursday. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 3 points. This is NPR News. In Iowa, thousands of people have been forced out of their homes by a rising Mississippi River. Flooding along the river system has so far caused more than $2 billion in damage over the last 2 weeks. And thousands of volunteers and Army personnel continue their sandbagging efforts. In the area around Des Moines, at least 250,000 people are without drinking water, and thousands of others are without power. The governor of Iowa calls the flooding the worst natural disaster ever in the state. Some officials say it may take up to 1 month before tap water in Des Moines is safe to drink again. PLO leader Yasser Arafat says that there have been direct contacts between his organization and the Israeli government. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Yasser Arafat told Reuters in Tunis that in the past month there have been two meetings between Israeli officials and senior members of his organization, but that they have produced no results. Aides to Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin denied there had been contacts. But the independent Israeli newspaper Haaretz today quoted a senior political source in Israel that the meetings had occurred with the knowledge of both Rabin and Arafat. If true, it would mark another step in Israel's move toward including the PLO in the Middle East peace process. Israel earlier this year repealed a ban on meetings between Israeli citizens and members of the PLO. But the Israeli government has said there is no place at the peace table for the PLO, which it sees as a terrorist organization bound on destroying the State of Israel. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Three powerful earthquakes have struck northern Japan, killing a number of people and destroying numerous homes. The first quake, measuring 7.8 on the Richter scale, trapped dozens of people inside a small hotel. Officials warned residents to leave northern coastal areas because of tidal waves. The quake was centered in an ocean area some 500 miles north of Tokyo. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Edward Bunker is among the tiny band of American prisoner writers whose work possesses integrity, craftsmanship, and moral passion in sufficient measure to claim our serious attention. William Styron wrote that in the introduction to the new edition of Bunker's 1973 novel, No Beast So Fierce. The novel was made into the 1978 film Straight Time, which starred Dustin Hoffman. Bunker also wrote the screenplay for Runaway Train. He spent most of the first part of his life behind bars. I asked him to read a section from No Beast So Fierce. It's about a chase during a heist. I'll let Bunker introduce it.
Yeah, this is sort of rather towards the third part of the novel, and it's about they've been working their ways up to bigger scores, and they've and they decided to take a big jewelry store in Beverly Hills, you know, with a lot of diamonds and stuff. And Straight Time, they did a good job of it, filming it. It's one of the best scenes in the movie. And they've been told on. They don't know it, but they've been told on. But whoever told didn't know exactly where they were going to pull a robbery, just that it was going to be in Beverly Hills, a jewelry store. So it goes bad while they're in it, and the alarm goes up, and they're surrounded, and they got to run, and they, you know, fight their way out of it. And as they runs with his partner is killed. And this is what happens, you know, this is as he's running wildly down the street. The unbelievable happened. The policeman sauntered from the alleyway, pistol dangling from his hip, a twisted smile on his face. He walked toward the wriggling body. He'd seen only Jerry. He didn't know where there were two of us. The black uniform had white sergeant chevrons. The short-cropped blonde hair shone in the sunlight. He was 15 feet away. Dire necessity guided my actions, but there was joy, too, and joy of hate expressed. He went down, leg blown out from under him, blood darkened over hip and thigh. I leaped forward, looking for his service revolver. It was on the dust 5 feet away. His trim uniform became filthy the moment he landed. Pain and shock marred the boyish face. He would beg. He would plead for mercy, mention wife and children. Policemen never admit begging for mercy, but they do it more often than criminals. Begging would make no difference. Even if he hadn't shot Jerry, he was going to die. He didn't beg. He glared. "You haven't got the guts," he said. "They'll get you, and you know it." It was amazing to view a man confronting mortality who believed that retribution is divinely ordained, that righteousness would protect him. "It doesn't make any difference to you," I said. I put my foot on his neck, forced him down, and put two bullets through his heart. The hollow-point ammunition blew his life out his back. In the last instant, already dead, his eyes registered that he saw the truth. Jerry still flopped weakly, like a fish expiring on a ship's deck. His eyes were sightless and glassy. Formless sounds mingled with blood from his mouth. Dark arterial blood thickened the dust, turned it into a rich mud. I thought of dragging him to the prowl car and using it for a getaway. I thought of putting him out of his misery. I could do neither.
Thank you for reading that. Is this an incident based on a personal experience?
No. No, this is a lot of these things with the shooting. Mostly I've run when I've been shot at, you know. But I've talked to people that have been on death row, that have been in those kind of situations, and, you know, what they felt, what they thought, you know, what happened. And I've talked to a lot of them. I know one guy who was on that wound up on death row for killing a policeman 8 years before. They'd surround him, and he'd thrown his gun down, and they shot him anyway. So the next time, he killed a policeman. And I've known people that that I know would rather die than get caught. You know, that they would rather hold what they call whole court on the streets and just be killed, but they're not ready for, at the moment when they come down on them, your mind has to be locked into a certain state of mind right at the moment that it happens to choose death. And the FBI is very good at grabbing people when they're unexpected, when they're not ready, you know, when you're not ready to die, you know. And so most of the things that I write about in this are either from my experience or from what people have told me, and this kind of thing is from what people have told me. I've never killed anybody, no.
You stabbed a guard at a prison once.
Yeah, when I was 15 years old.
Was that during a prison riot?
No, it was I had escaped from the hole, and I was going to stab an informer, a stool pigeon, and they cornered me and threw tear gas, and I jumped out a window, and one of them tackled me from behind, and when I went down, I stabbed him. Not bad, but, you know.
How were you punished for that?
They took me out and put me in the L.A. County Jail on what they call high power, which was all the cases facing death penalties and things. I was there for a while, and I got the judge gave me probation, and then because I was so young, I was only 15, turned 16, there was no place to send me. I'd already been through all the juvenile joints, so he gave me a county jail sentence, and I got out, and I went back in. And then I escaped from the jail, and finally they sent me to San Quentin. So I wound up doing about 6 years on the charge. That was the charge that I went to prison for.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel anything for the guard that you stabbed?
No. I mean, like remorse or bad for him. I didn't hurt him very bad. He wasn't hurt very bad.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I was hurt a lot worse than he was, believe me.
When you were young, did crime give you an identity, a sense of yourself?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I was always adventurous, and I didn't want to go along with the program. I mean, I was a chronic runaway, and one thing leads to another. You get, you know, most they start young. My parents were divorced when I was 4, and they put me in foster homes, and I was a chronic runaway. Well, you run away, and you steal a bicycle to get away. And you're hungry, and you break into a little market, you know, and steal stuff, and one thing progresses to another. They catch you and you go to juvenile hall, and some guy teaches you how to hotwire a car, and it's a value. You develop a whole ethical and a value system, an underworld antisocial value system. And it's accepted by the peer group, by those around you, and it becomes yours. You know, that's how anybody does. They accept the value system that they're taught. Everybody is what they're taught.
My guest was Edward Bunker. His 1973 novel, No Beast So Fierce, has just been republished. Back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer and ex-convict Edward Bunker. You were on the FBI's 10 most wanted list for a while?
Once upon a time, yeah.
What got you on there?
It was really some forgeries and suspicion of something that I wasn't guilty of, but it was really I was wanted for forgeries. Those were was the charge.
Were you proud in a way? Did you feel like you'd made it to the top?
Well, it's kind of a, you know, yeah, not, I wouldn't say proud, but it scared me. I know that, but because it puts a lot more heat on you. They used to only put you on the 10 most wanted when they knew they were going to arrest you the next day.
To look impressive.
To look impressive. That's true. You know, and it kept me from going to Cuba. I was in Florida at the time in Miami, and it was when Castro was still in the mountains of. In Cuba, and I thought I was going to go down there and join him.
To be a revolutionary?
Yeah. At that time, he was very favored by the United States. You know, he wasn't, in the late 50s, you know, before he took over, while he was still in the Sierra Maestre, in the mountains up there, his press in the United States was very favorable.
Did
I was pro-Castro, huh? And I was going to be a revolutionary, yes. And I was, you know, essentially I wanted to get away from here. You know?
Did anybody recognize you from your 10 most wanted FBI photo that appeared in post offices when you were on
no,
the most
but
wanted
I was,
list?
No, but I was afraid that they would.
Uh-huh.
That's what made me hesitant to try and... I didn't know it, and I was in Florida. I was in Miami, and I went into a post office, and I saw my, you know, my picture there. It scared me to death. And that's really the reason I didn't go. You know?
Did you run out of the post office?
No, I didn't quite, but I left quickly. You know what I mean? I don't think I quite ran, but it was, I got out of there. You know?
Was it a good photo?
No, it was a bad photo. But still, who knows, you know? You'd be surprised how many people, you know, recognize you.
Right. So it's been 20 years since you were in prison. What have you been doing for the past 20 years? How have you earned a living? What's your day-to-day life like?
I live the life of a writer. I work as a writer. I do all right. My books do fairly well. I get some movie writing work, rewriting work. I get a little acting work here and there. I live a very kind of very quiet life. It's pretty good. I have a great life, actually. I sleep, I get up, I go to eat breakfast, I clean the house, do all the housework, and I write. I write 7 days a week, and I have good friends. I have a good wife.
Do you find yourself being shocked now at the kinds of crimes that are committed, or...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's the gratuitous violence, the premium on violence. And I'm really one of these people, I believe that you take role models in Cagney and Bogart and those guys back then, well, they'd kill a dirty rat. But now Al Pacino just cuts loose with a machine gun and kills everybody. And I believe that life imitates art. I believe that the level of violence in the arts and movies and television really affects the society. I believe it has that, and I am shocked by the degree of gratuitous violence that's, you know, people don't... I mean, I just wanted to steal money, love. You know, I didn't want to hurt nobody. You know, I may hurt somebody if I had to, but now they want to rob you and they want to hurt you too. And that's a whole lot of difference, you know.
So,
I mean, if somebody would just give me the money or I'd been an heir, I wouldn't have been a criminal.
The character in your novel says, if society wanted me to behave by its moral code, it shouldn't have put me in foster homes and reform schools. Right. Do you blame society for...
No, I don't
the
blame society.
Uh-huh.
No, but society should recognize that society, America, gets the crime that it deserves. The individual may be innocent, that the individual victim may be innocent, but the society, we have a society that lives the main ideology, whatever we say, is materialism. What you have is what you are. And if you're poor and you're black and you're underprivileged and you're not educated and you're raised down in the projects, my mother, if you go down to the Jordan Downs Project and watch, and in the evening and you watch all those televisions, you can walk by those homes that every television set that just comes out of every window has a TV set. That's the babe, the watch of those kids play. They never learn any. The mothers can't handle them. By the time they reach puberty, about 13, they start wanting the material goods of society. That television tells them they should have the BMW, the Nike shoes, the whole good life, and they realize that they can't read and write, that they're illiterate, that there's absolutely no way for them to have that. And so why should they go for society? I mean, if you expect somebody to behave by a social contract, you've got to give them some vested interest in it. You got to reward them, don't you? I mean, why should anyone go along with the rules that people put if you don't get some of the payoff for it?
Do you have another book or screenplay in the works now?
Yeah, I have a book about three killers that I'm two-thirds through, and I have a couple scripts that I'm almost done with and a couple more that I'm hustling around town, you know.
Do you think that although you don't commit crimes anymore, you'll be writing about them for the rest of your life?
Oh, yeah, because that's what I know about, you know. I write about other things, too. I got a dog story, too, and I'm trying to hustle, you know. But essentially, I write about criminal. That's what, you know, Dostoevsky wrote. I mean, you know, after he went to prison for 7 years, that's what he wrote about. You know. That's what they tell you, you know, rule number one of creative writing, write about what you know.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yes, dear.
Edward Bunker's 1973 novel, No Beast So Fierce, has just been republished by Vintage Crime. This is Fresh Air. Des Moines' water supply has been contaminated by the flood. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on the flood on All Things Considered?
That's one of the things most Americans don't ever really expect, that our own clean water supply is going to be interrupted in a big city like Des Moines, and it's causing terrible problems. Edward Lifson has gone out from Chicago to cover that story. Vice President Al Gore is in the flood area, and we'll have a report on that from St. Louis. And from LeMay, Missouri, an up-close and personal look at the flood from a man who is in it. He talks about how it smells, the worms floating by, all sorts of things on the flood, Terry.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Free jazz emerged as a dominant style in improvised music in 1965. Before then, trumpeter Don Cherry worked for or recorded with most of the band leaders then revolutionizing jazz, Ornette Coleman, John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, and Albert Eiler. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that when Cherry began making records under his own name, he had a lot of influences to draw on, but the best ideas were his own.
In the mid-1960s, free jazz risked becoming a succession of long, tedious solos that never got anywhere, played over a static, thrashing rhythm, risked becoming what the style's detractors always accuse it of being. In those fiery days, musicians just wanted to get up and blow. 20-minute solos were not uncommon. When that era's quintessential sideman, Don Cherry, began recording for Blue Note in 1965, he'd hit on a way to bring form and variety to free jazz without giving up the intensity continuous music-making builds. His solution was ingeniously simple. Each side of an LP, about 20 minutes long, would consist of a single non-stop performance. But the blowing would be sparked or deflected every few minutes by some new theme or a prearranged interlude. That gave the musicians fresh material to bounce off or to jumpstart them when their energy or inspiration ran down. Here's a transitional passage from Cherry's Symphony for Improvisers. In Don Cherry's 60s music, there's an easy flow between written and improvised episodes. The written melodies themselves, sometimes reminiscent of Ornette Coleman's folksy tunes or Albert Eiler's fanfares, readily lend themselves to paraphrase and free variation. Those are some reasons why this music still sounds fresh almost 30 years later. The three albums Don Cherry made for Blue Note have finally been reissued in a 2-CD or 3-LP box from the mail-order label Mosaic of Stamford, Connecticut. Each of these albums, Complete Communion, Symphony for Improvisers, and Where is Brooklyn, feature Gatto Barbieri and or Pharoah Sanders on tenor sax. In truth, neither they nor Cherry are always the most riveting soloists here. The unsung heroes of these sessions are bassist Henry Grimes and drummer Edward Blackwell. They push the music ahead and glue it together. This is from the quartet session Complete Communion. Argentina's Gatto Barbieri is on tenor. Edward Blackwell, who died last October at age 62, was one of the truly great jazz drummers. He combined straight-ahead swing, West African cross rhythms, and the syncopated parade beats of his native New Orleans, sometimes all at once. Some bass players found it hard to fit in with Blackwell because he might play on the beat or ahead of the beat or behind it. Henry Grimes is too sure and resourceful to let that trip him up. Listen to Grimes and Blackwell kick Don Cherry along on Ella Fantasy. Mosaic reissues are known for their fastidious documentation and often for containing previously unissued material. So their Don Cherry box is a slight letdown. There were no alternate takes to include, and the annotation consists mostly of the liner notes to the original LPs. Even so, it's an important reissue. At a time when self-proclaimed traditionalists dismiss 60s jazz as formless, unswinging, and monotonous, Cherry's Blue Note records suggest some historically minded people have got their history wrong.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator living in New York. Fresh Air's senior producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our program is directed this week by Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Sister Helen Prejean. She works with inmates in Louisiana on death row and the families of their victims. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.